We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to a Tuesday edition of the RotoWire NBA podcast. Nick Whalen here with Alex Perutha. Alex, we made it. I guess we're not quite to the playoffs, but we are to the play-in tournament, which begins on this Tuesday night. We get the 7 and 8 matchups between the Hawks and the Heat and the Timberwolves and the Lakers. On Wednesday, we will be treated to Bulls Raptors and Thunder Pelicans. And then come Friday, we will have the final play-in games to determine the official playoff field. But we'll do a little bit of playoff talk here. We want to spend most of the episode covering some underrated storylines, both fantasy and non-fantasy from this season. You know, it feels like we kind of talk about the same, like 10 or 15 things over and over and over. So we want to just kind of highlight some of the lesser known storylines from this year. We'll spend most of the episode on that, but I think we should address the Timberwolves Lakers game and especially the Timberwolves situation, because we at least have a little bit of time to get this out before that game tips. You can hear a lot more in-depth coverage of all these playing games on the RotoWire NBA show, by the way, on SiriusXM NBA channel 86. We'll be on there at 7 Eastern every night that there is a game from here until the end of the NBA finals. So that includes tonight. We'll be talking about these two games. How are you handicapping Lakers Wolves with no Gobert? And in my opinion, more importantly, no Jaden McDaniels. We're seeing the Lakers right now as 8.5-point favorites.
Yeah, that's a pretty significant spread. It's tough. So much of this is going to fall on Anthony Edwards' shoulders from an offensive perspective, I think, because you want Towns to get more involved, but Anthony Davis is going to guard him. And then on the other end, I don't trust Cat to guard Anthony Davis. So I anticipate Minnesota doubling Anthony Davis a lot. We'll see how that works out for them. But those were kind of my initial thoughts.
Yeah, I was talking with our producers on the XM Fantasy show this morning, and they're big gamblers, and they were right away, they're on Anthony Davis points, Anthony Davis rebounds, Anthony Davis points and rebounds. And I get the logic there. And I should say, I think the Lakers win this game. I'm going to take Minnesota to cover. Like, it's such an obvious spot where the Lakers should have the advantage. They're at home, but I don't necessarily trust this Lakers team in these situations quite yet. I don't think they really have an overall killer instinct. It's not necessarily LeBron related, but I think 5 to 10 years ago, if there was a LeBron team in a one game playoff situation, I don't care who his teammates were at any point, you just kind of thought like, oh boy, this is over. LeBron's going to pick us apart. He's probably going to go for 40, 15, and 10. And he was going to be setting up guys for great looks, and they're going to figure out a way to do it. The Lakers are the better team in this scenario against Minnesota. But I feel like time and time again, they don't necessarily have a good sense of the moment. They let their guard down defensively. In their defense, they went 2-0 against the Utah Jazz in the last week. They almost lost both of those games, yeah. And they were both really important. So I think we've seen them in these seemingly how could you possibly lose this game situations, and they don't always put their foot on the gas when they can.
You're right. I do think you can chalk some of that up to them being a very veteran team. Between LeBron, AD's hurt pretty often, and even Westbrook earlier in the year, obviously, is a veteran at this point. I think a lot of those guys try to coast when they can. Mm-hmm. But you're right. It's so, I mean, they're, you know, going from this regular season where they completely remade their team at the trade deadline. Our sample size with the new team is really small because LeBron was out and D'Angelo Russell hasn't played that much. And then you go from a team that was basically trying to like maintain health a lot of the year. And now you're going into the playoffs. You wonder if they have that extra gear.
Exactly. You want to see it at some point. And it's not to say that the Lakers haven't had good wins every now and then. They are somehow the best team in the Western Conference since the All-Star break. That I was astonished when I saw that stat. I think that speaks more to just how, you know, generally average the rest of the conference has been. But nonetheless, that does hold up. And what an interesting situation overall, by the way, that like, can you ever remember a year where almost unanimously everybody trusts the like 6 seed, 4 seed, and possibly 7 seed more than the top 3 seeds in a conference to win the title?
No, I don't think so. Part of it too, is we had just so many years with LeBron versus the Warriors. Yeah. That I think that skewed our perspective on some things. But even before that, I don't remember it being that way.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, it always felt like there was one dominant team or maybe even multiple dominant teams per conference. And we just don't have that in the West. And it's especially jarring in the West because for the East, that was the case for a long time. And it was kind of just whatever team LeBron was on basically for a decade was the prohibitive favorite. But out West, you know, we had so many juggernaut teams year after year. And you know, for it to just feel like it's as wide open as it is still, it is pretty wild. What is your overall lean on this Lakers T-Wolves game? And then we'll move on. I don't want to spend too much time on Hawks heat. Frankly, don't care about that one quite as much. But if it stays at 8.5, where are you going there?
I mean, my lean is the Lakers win. I don't really want to mess with the spread because it's a little too big for my liking for a game like this. But I would just take the Lakers money line and do that.
Okay. I think the Wolves are going to miss McDaniels a lot. I think not having him to throw at LeBron. You know, Kyle Anderson is more successful at guarding LeBron than you'd think, but that's still not an ideal matchup for him. You know, you don't have Naz Reid either to back up what would have been Rudy Gobert's spot. So they're in a difficult spot there, but I think we're in agreement. You know, Lakers win this game, but it's maybe not as easy as everyone imagines. Let's get to underrated storylines from the season, Alex. I wrote down, I told you to do like 3 to 5. I have closer to like 12 to 15. I will not be getting to all of these. I'm just going to kind of pick and choose as we go on the fly. Maybe you'll have some of the same ones so I could cross them off. But for that reason, I'll let you lead us off. Give us one of your underrated storylines from the 2022-23 NBA season.
I think it's flown under the radar. You know, the Pacers, basically, they kind of tanked the season away late. I think it's really important to note that they were exactly 500 when Tyrese Halliburton played. And by all other accounts, this team is just not that good. Like, you know, later in the year, they've looked worse than they were, but Miles Turner, like Aaron Nesmith, Buddy Hield, Andrew Nembhard, Tyrese Halliburton, for all intents and purposes, that was a starting lineup. And their bench was pretty bad too. Duarte took a step back. Mathurin had his moments earlier in the year, but then kind of hit the rookie wall. We talk about him as one of the more elite fantasy players. His stats are perfect for it, but it's translating to real life wins. And they're a team that I'll get to this a little bit later, but they're a team with cap room as well.
In a summer when not a ton of teams have cap room, which makes it extra important. I mean, it's not a fantastic free agency class, but we're also at that point where you look around and say, man, maybe nobody's going to be on the move. And then 3 months from now, you know, 2 or 3 guys that we're not even talking about end up switching teams. So yeah, I have a kind of a somewhat similar point that I'll bring up later of another team that if they want to, you know, is in position to make some pretty significant upgrades. So, I mean, what is the overall storyline here? Just that Tyrese Halliburton is even better in real life than we think.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a little bit of like a Shai Gilgeous-Alexander situation where it's like, and where we saw this maybe a year or two ago from SGA, mm-hmm. where if you start digging into the numbers, the on-off stuff, if you really like are sensitive to turnovers and defense and things like that, it's like this guy is clearly a winning player when he's on the floor, like this could be, it's weird to think of Halliburton as a potential superstar because his game is his, the way he moves is kind of bizarre. His shot's weird looking, you know, it's easier to sort of envision SGA as that guy because he makes a lot more impact plays. But I think Halliburton is legitimately a guy who 3-4 years from now, we could be looking at as someone who's really affecting winning on a team that goes relatively far in the playoffs.
All right, I'm going to stay with another just middling Eastern Conference team for my first one. The Bradley Beal fall off.
Yeah.
What is going on here? Both in real life and more so in fantasy. It total value 8 categories for 4 straight seasons, excuse me. Beal finished 17th, 8th, 10th, and 11th. He has now finished 171 and 111 each of the last 2 years. Obviously, he's missed time, but that's part of the calculation. Per game value, from 2018 to 2021, he finished 13th, 11th, and 12th. So basically a first-round value for 3 straight years. The last 2 years, he has finished 46th and 44th. Not totally uncommon for players to, you know, experience decline as their careers go along. But there's not a ton of precedent, especially in the modern NBA when guys are playing very well into their mid-30s. Bradley Beal's 29. Like, you don't start falling off when you turn 27.
No, it's weird. I mean, I didn't watch a ton of Wizards this year, partially because Beal wasn't that healthy.
Yeah, right.
He struggled with injuries, too.
Yeah, well, that's totally part of it, and that goes into the total value. I mean, he's played 90 games over the last 2 years. Those were both full seasons, so that's not ideal. But, you know, it's weird because I say fall off, but he shot 50% from the field this year. He had his most efficient shooting season of his entire career, yet he's still down 8 points per game from 2 years ago. He's taking markedly fewer threes. He's taking like half as many threes as he was 3 seasons ago when he was at his absolute peak, averaging 31 a game. This is more so a fantasy point than a real life point, because I don't know that Bradley Beal is like quote unquote getting worse as a player, but I mean, this was a guy that was in that like top 10, top 15 player in the league discussion. And, you know, I think a couple of years ago, you could have debated like Bradley Beal versus Donovan Mitchell versus Devin Booker, you know, guys like that, Damian Lillard even. And like that whole group of players who were in the same caliber as him 2 or 3 years ago have all ascended, and he's just kind of stayed the same.
It's just a lot of coasting. Like when you see him, it just feels like he's a guy who's sort of just coasting along. I mean, you talk about, it doesn't seem like he's interested in leaving Washington for a winning situation. He just likes it there. You watch him play. He defers a lot to Kyle Kuzma and Porzingis. Like when you sit down and watch a Wizards game, it's like half the time you're like, whose team is this? Is it Kuzma's team? Is it Porzingis' team? Like, in theory, it's Beal's, but he just defers so much to those guys where a lot of times it just seems like it's almost like he's trying to conserve energy out there. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, he comes out at his exit interview yesterday and is like, yeah, I'm frustrated. This team isn't good enough. It's like, dude, what? Like, you signed up for this. Like, you openly could have gotten out of this multiple times. I'm reading a tweet right now that says Brad Beal and Damian Lillard are in abusive relationships with their own teams. It does kind of feel that way, man. Like, I think it's more of a dire situation for Dame given his age and, you know, the fact that he's a better player. But I think both of those guys are if you're looking for like, who are we not talking about now who could be on a different team come mid-July, I think those guys might be 1 and 2 on the list.
I think so.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
The NBA regular season has come and gone, which means it's time for a new way to play daily fantasy basketball for the playoffs. Rival Fantasy is the fantasy platform reinventing the way daily and weekly games are played, and they brought three new games to the ballpark this year that fantasy players won't find anywhere else. With unique games like Fantasy Bingo, head-to-head player challenges, and over-unders in Fantasy Book, daily fantasy has never been better. Right now, RotoWire listeners can get a $50 protected first play. That means if you win your first play, you keep your winnings. But if you lose your first entry, Rival Fantasy will fully refund you up to $50. Go to play.rivalfantasy.com/signup. Again, that's play.rivalfantasy.com/signup. And use our code ROTOWIREMBA, all one word, ROTOWIREMBA. Use that at signup and deposit a minimum of $25 to get your first entry on Rival protected up to $50. Now's the time to step onto the court and become a Rival today. Welcome to the arena.
All right, one of my next ones. I think if you're in the fantasy space, you know this happened, but I'm not sure the casual NBA fan is really like Markel Fultz is, I think, legitimately like really good. Like
yep. I think he's had this on my list. Love it.
I don't know if he's a. It's hard to say where he sort of sits in like the hierarchy. If you're trying to win a title or if you're trying to get to the Eastern Conference Finals, is he a starter? That's a little bit more difficult for me to say, but 8-cat this year, at least in fantasy, finished 74th. He makes a highlight play on offense and on defense every single game. Takes care of the basketball. Wasn't abysmal from three. Didn't take that many. 31%. His free throw percentage is fine. 80%. But when he's out there, he's legitimately impacting both sides of the floor. Is an insane athlete. Like, he had a very, very good year.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think the fantasy community has been in on this for a while. More importantly, he played 60 games. Like he missed time early on, but once he came back, he basically played every game the rest of the way. Defensively, he didn't even play 30 minutes a game. He was still at a steal and a half per game. The assists were up this year, and I think another kind of underrated part of his game is, this was part of the just the mental issues and the jump shot falling apart and everything, but. Yeah, like his first 2 years in the league, he was shooting like 48% from the line, and he's basically an 80% free throw shooter now. So I don't know if we're ever going to get to the point where the jump shot resembles anything like it was, his freshman year at Washington. It was so smooth. Everything looked great. Like I don't think that's coming back at this point. Although he is only 24. That's the other thing. It kind of seems like he's like 27 by now, but that's not the case. I don't think he's ever going to be a plus 3-point shooter. The mechanics of the jumper still look bad. But at the very least, this is not a, somewhat of a similar trajectory, I guess, to Lonzo Ball, but, Fultz gets to the line, 2.5 times per game and he makes them. So I think you can live with him, being a poor shooter in other ways, if he's at least able to capitalize at the line.
100%. And maybe his fate, longer term on a winning team is sixth man. But if Markel Fultz ends up with a sixth man of the year award in his future, I think that's very possible for him.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. You could kind of tell me anything of where is Markel Fultz in 5 years? It's like, has he made an all-star game? I don't know. Like that seems plausible with how much progress he's made when healthy. You forget he tore his ACL on top of everything else that happened. So he's kind of had to restart his career like two separate times now. If he could just have, if he could string together two or three healthy years in a row, which hopefully he can, I said, I don't, you could tell me he's made three straight all-star games in the year 2028.
It's possible. It's tough when you're a point guard that can't shoot, but other guys have made it work.
Yeah. Super fun player to watch nonetheless. Kristaps Porzingis. I wanted to mention him quick. I'm not doing back-to-back Wizards points,
right.
But he's basically been the opposite of Beal.
He was on my list.
Yeah. 15th in total value this season. And that's with missing some games at the end of the year, 14th in per game value. He had, relative to expectations, I think one of the best fantasy seasons. So I wanted to mention that quick. If you have anything to add on him while we're on it, feel free.
Well, I think we talked about when we made our all NBA teams, depending on how sensitive you are to games played. And if you're pretty strict about positions, there's a legitimate case for Porzingis. Like, just statistically, he's very good this year.
Let's see. Where do I want to go next? I'm going to go all the way to the bottom of my list. Onyeka Okongwu. I want to talk Okongwu here. I think he is the best player in the league who is not playing at least 25 minutes per game. And he did cross the 20-minute threshold finally this season. Per 36, he's basically been an amazing backup center for three straight years. This year, per 36, 15 points, 11 rebounds, almost two assists, 2.1 blocks, 1.1 steals. He's become a much better free throw shooter. He's up like 15 percentage points from his rookie year, 78% this year, almost four attempts per 36. He's 64% from the field. I don't want to say that the Hawks are like stunting his growth because, you know, Clint Capella is ahead of him. He's played well. John Collins, for whatever reason, is still on the team, and he's a very good player as well. So I get why his minutes are limited. I just think if he was on a different team, almost like it doesn't even have to be a bad team, like a team that just doesn't have Clint Capella, basically, I think we would be talking about this guy as like the next Bam Adebayo. So whenever this happens, like they're coming up on the decision, you know, he'll be in his fourth year next year. So they picked up his fourth year option. At that point, you know, they're either gonna have to sign him to what'll be a pretty lucrative long-term deal, or some other team is going to swoop in and do that. But I just want to highlight like how amazing he has been. I think he's like, he's not really in the sixth man of the year race for whatever reason. That tends to go to guards. But he's one of the best young big men in the league.
It's a tough situation. You're completely right. If he was the starting center for the Oklahoma City Thunder, he'd be putting a few numbers.
Be the one seed.
Yeah, exactly. Capella's got two more years on his deal. So maybe there's a team that would take Capella. Maybe it's just better off to trade Okongwu if you're trying to win now. But you're completely right. I mean, he's been very good. And it does feel like a situation where I think Atlanta would like to move on, but they just don't. It's easier said than done.
He's a top 65 fantasy player this year and in fewer than 2,000 minutes. I mean, it's wild, man. Like he's basically played like the same amount of minutes as like Kawhi Leonard or like Miles Turner, who's missed a ton of time.
Yeah, one thing that's interesting to me, I mean, he's actually relatively short, like he's 6'9".
Yeah.
He's taken more long mid-rangers this year. He took 51, which I know doesn't sound like a lot, but last year he took three. Made 45% of his long mid-rangers this year, which is pretty good. I don't know if there's a future in which they dump Collins and they maybe have Okongwu and Capella play next to each other. I don't know. We just haven't seen Okongwu out on the perimeter. You know, like if you talk about him like Bam is someone who's out on the perimeter. Bam's going to guard Trae Young tonight half the time.
Right.
So it's kind of tough to say what their plan is with him, but he's branching out his game a little bit at least, which I think is good. One guy I wanted to highlight for me, who of course got lost in the shuffle, is Devin Vassell this year.
Hell yeah.
Exactly. Devin Vassell he only played 30 minutes in 24 games, but he averaged 20 points a game in those games, shot 39% from three on 7.5 attempts, got to the free throw line for three attempts a game, which is not a ton, but considering he's more of a wing. So he was averaging like 20 points, five rebounds, four assists and a steal in the games where he shot 30 minutes. Like, I think he's actually very good. It's just, we didn't see that much of him. If you talk about someone who completely flew under the radar, he added when he played, like he actually ranked 88th per game in fantasy this year. He was very good, way better than Keldon Johnson.
Yeah, I think Keldon Johnson is still, for better or for worse, like the face of this rebuild, at least for the time being. But I think you're right. Vassell's a much better player. I mean, in those games you mentioned where he played at least 30 minutes, he shot almost 40% from three on eight attempts per game, which is really, really good. His first 17 games of the year when the Spurs were like somewhat of a real team, that's when we actually saw the real him. I mean, he was 45% from the field in that span, 22 points per game. After that, it just got really messy. He was hurt for a while. He missed like almost all of January and February. And then I think anything that happened after that, you kind of have to throw out. He was in and out of the lineup. He had a couple nice games. They were tanking pretty hard at that point. And then he didn't play the final eight games of the year. But no, that's a great point. I think we still think of the Spurs team as like a blank slate. in a lot of ways. And obviously, if they land Wembanyama, that changes the calculus immediately and considerably. But no, Vassell's, he's in a really good spot. Nobody talks about him. Like he went to Florida State, which is not a small school by any means. But I just feel like San Antonio has been so off the radar these last couple of years that unless you're talking about them tanking or you're talking about Greg Popovich, like nobody actually talks about what's going on the court.
No, and I understand this was a completely lost year for them, and you know, on an ideal situation, he would not be scoring 20 a game for you. But I think it's important to highlight that he did.
All right, I'm going to throw out a somewhat abstract one, and you know, with the caveat that I'm not like an analytics guy by any means, so I'll be soliciting your opinion on if this actually means anything. But okay. I found it interesting that for the first time since all the way back in 2010 to 2011, 3-point attempts per game are down in the NBA. And that is with pace going up year over year. So down a full 3-point attempt per game from last season to this season.
That is interesting. My guess, so I have two thoughts on this. My two thoughts would be, I think the floater is becoming more of like a quote unquote acceptable shot. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there are a lot of situations where guys, and it's become a really effective shot for a lot of different players, that like 13 foot just flip floater. And I think with so many guys, opposing defenses going over screens, you get pushed into that area. And before it was like, well, you don't want to take it, it's a mid-ranger. But guys have really discovered how close you can get to that drop big. Mm-hmm. You can get 15 feet. Sometimes it's even like you're like 7 feet away from the basket. And those shots are really not that far away for an NBA player who's like just practicing a little flip. So I think that's there too. And some of these teams, like especially OKC and in Utah, they are cutting a lot more off the 3-point line because everybody's got their head turned. And I think that's a huge part of it too. Like there's fewer guys just literally standing there doing absolutely nothing. And this was something I actually was thinking about the other day. You know, so many of these guys, Joe Harris, Duncan Robinson, who got these huge contracts for being basically spot up 3-point shooters who could do a little bit off the move. They're just, those are look like bad contracts now. And I think it's because those guys are not a threat to cut ever. And now I think in the modern NBA, you have to be a threat to cut off that, catch a ball with a head of steam at the free throw line and like make something happen, because defenses are too good at covering spot up guys now.
I think those are all great points. It's also worth noting that attempts inside the restricted area are up this year as well, about a half per game, which doesn't seem like that much, but obviously over the course of 82 games for 30 teams, that's a lot of shots. And that's resulted in field goal percentage being at essentially an all-time high in like our modern era. You got to go all the way back to the late 80s where teams collectively shot 47.5% from the field. That is up like 1.5 percentage points from last year, which is huge, like going from 46.1 to 47.5. Part of that is more efficiency shooting the three. 3-point efficiency is up this year, although it's down from a couple years ago. I think some people would probably argue like residual effects, tired legs from the bubble, all that could just be year-to-year variance, who knows. But I also think, you know, we have more guys taking shots at the rim and more players converting those at a higher clip. So yeah, just an interesting year-over-year trend that I wanted to mention, because I think if you talk to anybody, like especially casual fans, they'll just be like, oh, it's all three-pointers. And there are some games you watch and it definitely does feel that way. But before I looked this up, I would not have guessed that three-pointers are actually technically down from last year, even though we're still, you know, way, way above where we were a decade ago. Like you think of like LeBron's first year in Miami with the Heat, the average team was taking 18 threes a game. Now the average team is taking 34 threes a game.
Yeah. And I think some of it too, is like teams playing small ball. I think teams realize, like, why don't we just drive at these guys? They're like 6'7" playing center. Mm-hmm. Like, just drive and go over them. You know, they're not going to block your floater even if you stop short. So, yeah, I think there is a little bit of a shift there. So that's a good thing to bring up. One of my points, I don't know if it's an underrated storyline, but it's something I just kind of thought about. So there was obviously a lot of teams that were better than we thought they would be this year, like surprise teams, right? Like Orlando, Utah, OKC, Indiana. Mm-hmm. A lot of these teams have cap room. yep. projected for next year. Like, I just grabbed this off a spot track. I would have to go in it and see exactly how accurate it is, but they have a projected practical cap space tab for next season. Orlando, $55 million. Utah, $49 million. OKC, $40 million. Indiana, $38 million. And it's interesting to me to consider which of these teams want to kind of play the long game. And if any of these teams will just say, you know, not that it's a great free agent class. I think that makes it, I think more teams will be willing to play the long game because the free agent class this year is like headlined by, I guess in theory, James Harden, you know, Kyrie, I think Porzingis.
I think Chris Middleton, technically.
Middleton's a free agent. D'Lo. These aren't like necessarily huge prizes other than Harden, but some teams, they don't want to disrupt their whole team for James Harden, stuff like that. But to me, it's these surprise teams, like they're going to have decent draft picks this year. They have a great culture, good coach, and a lot of cap room. And in especially the West, where things are looking pretty weak, you could make a move.
I had OKC on my list, and I just wrote OKC is going to be really good if they want to be good. Do they chase it next year? Like you mentioned, they could have, you know, 35, 40 mil in cap space, depending on what they do. They of course need to reserve some of that for like the million draft picks that they have. But I mean, just bringing in a competent center, I feel like is like plus five wins for them. And, you know, obviously it goes exponentially if you get somebody who's more than competent. You know, Chet Holmgren will help right away, but I don't think he's going to step in and be all that impactful. I think it's going to be more of a learning year for him, given how much time he's missed. But I mean, I think part of it is you look at the context of the Western Conference, and yes, all those teams were surprisingly better than we thought. But the other side of that is that means that other teams had to be worse than we thought. And like almost every other team falls into that category, right? It's like Denver and Memphis, they had nice years, same with Sacramento. But, you know, Phoenix, 45 wins based on that talent is really low. Obviously, injuries, trades are the reason for that. But I think this season, the regular season, is going to go down as a disappointment if you're just looking at expected wins versus actual wins. Same for the Clippers, same for the Warriors, same for the Lakers, same for Minnesota, New Orleans. Like the West is so open going forward. And this is kind of another mini point that I had on my list. Does that project to change next year? Like other than Phoenix having a full year in theory with Durant, you know, they're going to be here as long as he's playing at a high level. But like, I don't know, like does Memphis have another big jump in them? Does Sacramento have another big jump? Like Denver kind of feels like it is what it is. You know, Clippers, Lakers, they have a big time question marks. The Warriors are nearing the end of their run. Minnesota is in a really tough spot with the Gobert contract. New Orleans has big questions with Zion. Like I really think if OKC specifically plays this summer right, like they could go into next year as like a top three or four team in the West. Like I don't think that's out of the question at all.
I completely agree with you. Yeah, a lot of these West teams don't project to get meaningfully better unless they make some moves, you know, in free agency. I don't know what you do if you're OKC. I mean, I think you're okay giving up a lot of your depth pieces and your draft capital to do that.
I think so too. I think the big question, you know, we mentioned Beal and Lillard, and you know, maybe somebody else, maybe it's Towns or whatever, ends up being available. But like, I don't even know if any of those guys are real fits, either salary wise or basketball wise, on any of these teams. It's like,
right,
almost all these teams have good point guards. It's like, does Denver, like, you know, Jamal Murray, Ja Morant, De'Aaron Fox, Chris Paul? I guess like the Clippers are always going to be mentioned for guys like that, but money wise, that would be extremely difficult. You know, maybe the Lakers, but yeah, it's not like there's a team out there where you say like, oh, well, we could just assume that Damian Lillard is going to join the Dallas Mavericks. Like that won't even make any sense. They have two guards already. So yeah, I think there is a path for sure for these teams that have been tanking to accelerate this if they want to, because I do think the West is going to be wide open for the foreseeable future. And maybe that's just kind of the era that we're entering in general, right? Like for so long, you and I, in our formative years as NBA analysts, there was a dominant super team for like a decade straight, whether it was the Heat or the Warriors.
Yep.
And that's just kind of done now. And like, I don't know. Like, are we going to see another situation where we just feel like one team is completely inevitable?
I don't know. I mean, some of this comes down to, which we haven't really talked about, the new CBA, which seems like it's going to promote even more parity and promote good drafting and retaining those players. And especially with expansion coming, I think it will be a lot more wide open. which I like. You know, I think if you're a team like OKC, maybe the move is just like, hey, what is really our weakness? It's the bench. And all these teams, you know, these kind of surprise teams, they're not good because their bench is bad for the most part. Like, so maybe it's just a matter of, yeah, hey, maybe we can get Gary Trent on like a nice deal, or you know, the Josh Hart's a free agent. Maybe we can grab him or something like that.
Yeah.
But to your greater point, I think there will be parity going forward, and I prefer that, honestly. I know it's bad for like, it's bad for hero versus villain storylines, which drove a ton of traffic, obviously, right? Like for ESPN, you could always be like, good guys versus bad guys. You have to watch this game. But I think as the casual NBA fan, like, it's better when more teams are in it.
Back to you. Do you have any more in your chamber?
I don't really have like any big ones in my chamber. You sound like you have a lot, so I'll just
kind of run through some of them. We don't need to get on to every single one of these. One kind of more big picture point that I wrote down, being one of the 10 to 20 best players in the league is no longer enough for your team to be automatically good. Is that fair? I think another way to say that is the bar for being an elite player or an elite team, I think, is higher than it's ever been. And I am very interested to see how this impacts, you know, not only just general player status, but, you know, older, upper level, but not elite players. You know, how are they treated? Like, I think teams are going to look at Washington, they're going to look at Chicago specifically, and they're going to say, why would I want to pay DeMar DeRozan, you know, $40 million to be the 28th best player in the league and put up good numbers, but ultimately not really do anything? At some point, like, are guys like that going to get squeezed out? Are we going to see more of a quote unquote money ball approach in the NBA where like, there's just not much of a market for players like that? I think in some ways we're already seeing it with like the trade market for someone like a Bradley Beal. You know, like, teams are just not really willing to take on contracts that they view as low value contracts anymore. You kind of have to hunt for a team like Utah or OKC that's willing to take that on for, you know, pretty significant draft capital. So I'm just interested to see if we get more reticence from teams when it comes to, you know, kind of drawing the line and saying like, look, unless you're really pushing us into contention, like, we're not even going to do this. Like, we'd rather just hang out at the bottom for another year.
I think so. Yeah, I think we'll get more of these guys not signing max deals. They'll be below max deals, maybe shorter, shorter deals, but that could actually have them end up on some of the better teams in the NBA.
Right.
And then those teams. Right. So it'll be interesting to see what the effects of that are. Mm-hmm. And then maybe we will get more top heavy teams again. If the middle teams decide we don't really have any interest in Beal or DeRozan types.
Yeah. It's kind of the argument of like, we're not going to pay you the max just because you're eligible for the max. You know, I think like, will more teams actually make that stance? And I think there's maybe somewhat of a rough parallel here to like what's going on with Lamar Jackson in the NFL, right? Where it's like, look, we have questions about you. And this is a whole, you know, separate argument about collusion and whatnot. And I don't think we'll see that in the NBA, but I think Lamar is like the perfect polarizing player because he's been injured. He has a really unique style. Guys like that don't last into their 30s. It just doesn't happen in the NFL. And, you know, teams are basically like, no, we're taking a collective stand against this. So yeah, I just wonder like when the next Brad Beal like player says, give me the max or I'm leaving, will other teams just be like, well, we're not giving it to you either, pal. So you're going to have to settle for less.
Yeah. And along the same lines, I mean, with all the increased injuries in the NBA, I wonder if teams are going to be way more hesitant on injury prone guys, like the Zions of the world, like the Pelicans just handing him basically a supermax. I'm not saying they shouldn't have, because when he's on the floor, like, they're kind of hamstrung, right? Like, they have to, I don't know what they're supposed to do. They're in a horrible position. But I wonder if teams will be a little more cautious with those types of players. It's tough when they're superstars, though.
It is. But I think going back to my original point, I think the bar for being a superstar is so high right now that guys who would normally be superstars or in 10 years ago would have been one of the 10 best players in the league, they just get pushed down the line. You know, I think that's like part of the reason we don't talk about Brad Beal, is because so much talent has come into the league in the last 5 years that he went from being like the 13th best player to like the 35th best player partially because he's regressed a little bit, but I think arguably more so because just so many talented players are in the league. Like it again, it goes back to my kind of original point, which is just having Luka Doncic very clearly that got you 38 wins this year, you know, and you could put some of that on Luka, you could put it on the team building. But I think the general level of talent around the league is such that just having a really good player no longer guarantees you anything.
I agree.
I have just Ben Simmons written on my list here.
Is that underrated?
I think it is now. It wasn't early on. Like this was obviously a huge story coming into the year, but when's the last time you've even thought about Ben Simmons? For me, it's been months, you know, right when they first ruled him out, like a few months ago, I think you and I agreed, like, yeah, he's done for the year. He has not played in a game since February 15th. And he's like, really has not actually contributed for them since like January. He had that triple double in mid January, kind of felt like he was back for like a day. And, you know, was just really did nothing after that. I don't think his career is done. I don't know where we go from here. You know, fantasy wise, I don't think you can touch him next year. He's not expected to need any more surgeries on his back, but I mean, that alone would be concerning, let alone everything else that's gone on with him. It's just a remarkable career turn for a guy who, even after everything that happened in Philly, you know, like the yips and just, you know, not wanting to shoot the basketball, there were a lot of people that thought this was going to work really well in Brooklyn. And after this season now, it's totally fair to say like over under 50 more NBA games played in Ben Simmons' life.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I will say I thought it was going to be fine. I didn't think it was going to be this bad. I thought he'd be a decent fantasy player. I thought the fit would be okay. I thought Kyrie and KD would essentially be like distracting enough where Ben Simmons could be a role player and it would be fine. He has not played or did not play, however you want to phrase it, back-to-back 30-minute games since November. And you're right. When you think of the Nets, they're a rebuilding team. Mikal Bridges looks really good. I'm actually really interested to see how he does in this upcoming series against Philly. But I don't perceive Ben Simmons as part of their rebuilding core. I just don't think of him like that. He's just a guy who's on the team. Like, he's just kind of there. He's his own thing. He's not really part of the rebuild.
No, not at all. I think anything you get from him, I guess, is a bonus, is how you have to look at it. I mean, his contract is obviously maybe the worst in basketball right now, given that he's not giving you anything. And I think worse, it's one thing if he can't contribute on the court, but you can't trade it. Like, there's no team that wants that. Certainly not next year. Maybe 2 years from now when it becomes expiring. But you're gonna have to pay up for any team to take that. So, you know, I guess the Nets are strangely in a position now where it's not as harmful as it was when they still had Kyrie and KD, because obviously they were kind of chasing different goals at that point. But yeah, I mean, he was drawing LeBron comparisons like 2.5 years ago, man. And I think he's on his way to being out of the league if we're being completely realistic. The last thing that I had is kind of reassessing the 2021 draft class, which I still like a lot. But it doesn't really feel like any of these guys made like a major, major leap in year two. You know, I mean, Mobley is just, you know, you hear kind of like the subtle Tim Duncan comparisons. And I think it makes sense because you know, like, there's not a lot of highlight plays there. There's, you know, like the stats kind of look the same from last year, but he's going to get a ton of defensive player of the year votes. So I am exempting him from this, but I mean, Jalen Green, the same, if not taking a step back. Kate Cunningham, very concerning injury that basically caused him to miss the whole year. Scotty Barnes, I think, looked better than the numbers would indicate, but still didn't take that big leap. You know, Suggs, we'll see. He's kind of in the Chris Dunn zone still. Yeah, Josh Giddey improved in some areas, but still kind of iffy. Franz Wagner, about the same. Like, we were talking about this as like a potential all-time draft class, especially at the top. We always say, like, there's no draft class where all three guys ended up being really good, and this could maybe break that trend. But it, I don't know. It felt like an overall kind of disappointing season for what was a super, super promising class this time last year.
The Cade injury is tough.
Yeah.
Mobley might win defensive player of the year.
I was listening to, it was either the mismatch pod or the low pod. They were talking about their votes and like, yeah, Mobley's going to get way more votes than I thought.
Bill Simmons and Russillo both voted Mobley. And I saw some other, Someone got basically aggregated other people's votes. And I think Mobley had half of the defensive player of the year votes that were aggregated, which I think was 8, 9, or 10. So he might actually win it this year. I mean, the Jalen Green thing, I mean, they got rid of Steven Silas. A bunch of stories came out after he got fired, you know, him and ownership was not good. And Jalen Green wanted, you know, they wanted more plays so that things were like less free flowing, which actually makes sense. So I think Jalen Green and Cade Cunningham are both like very to be determined. And Barnes, I don't know. I think I was relatively lower on Barnes than some people, but only just from like a usage perspective of I just didn't know where the touches were coming from because the team is kind of the same. But I actually still have decent hope for this class. I think there are a lot of guys on this list who like Trey Murphy and Herb Jones both look really promising as like role guys. There are some interesting names in here still.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I just think there was not as much of a leap as I expected. I mean, Herb Jones is an interesting one too, because it feels like he kind of got bypassed by Trey Murphy.
Yeah, I mean, Jones is a defensive specialist. That's a problem. Like, he cannot, if he can't figure out the three-pointer, he's just going to be some guy, ironically, like Jose Alvarado, who just comes off the bench for 20 minutes a game and just to muck things up, which is fine. I mean, there's plenty of guys around. Like, if you draft a guy 35th and he plays 20 minutes a game and, you know, gives you that defense, that's a win.
I will say, I mean, all due respect to Davion Mitchell, I think he'll just be like a fine backup point guard for a while. Man, if they had one pickup and could have got Franz Wagner or really anybody who went in the top eight other than Suggs, I mean, that Kings team would be, I think, even more on an ascendant path. Like, you know, nobody talks about Davion Mitchell as like part of their young core, and for good reason. Like, he's fine, but he's not really somebody that you view as having a ton of upside. But the draft really fell off after Wagner at eight. It went Davion Mitchell, Zaire Williams, James Booknight, Josh Primo, which, talk about underrated storyline. People forget about that. That was this season, right? That was like first week of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. That was funny. You
can't be exposing yourself to team psychiatrists. You just can't.
I mean, and Zaire Williams for Memphis, what happened to him? He played 20 minutes a game last year. He's just gone.
He's played in 37 games this year, which is like double what I would have guessed. We have not heard a peep out of Zaire Williams.
No. So that's kind of bizarre too. And then Duarte was not good again this year.
No, he was really good for the first week of his rookie year. And I think, at least in my mind, has like still been coasting on that.
Yeah, maybe. But I don't know, man. I mean, Kispert, I kind of like Kispert. And Jalen Johnson is making things happen in Atlanta. Yeah. Grimes for New York. It's a fun class still.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I certainly don't feel as strong about Jalen Johnson as I do Okongwu, but I think he's another guy too. It's like, I wish he was on the Hornets. Like, I feel like he'd be giving the Hornets like 28 really good minutes a night. Hawks are such a weird roster. We could do a whole pod on that. I mean, maybe we will in the offseason. We'll end on this. So if Evan Mobley does in fact win Defensive Player of the Year, which the odds are down now that votes are becoming public, that makes sense. But it does seem like that's a very realistic possibility, partially because I think a lot of people were so split on Jaren Jackson and Brook Lopez that those guys are going to split a lot of votes. And then, you know, there's kind of this, the third party, Evan Mobley, might just sneak in and grab this. If he does indeed win it, he would become by far the youngest Defensive Player of the Year winner ever. Kawhi won it at age 23 in his fourth NBA season. Dwight Howard won it as a 23-year-old as well, but not until his fifth season. So nobody's ever won it as a 21-year-old, and no one's ever won it in their second season.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about him maybe sliding in because of the confusion about the other two guys. Kind of like how I thought there was a chance Giannis might win MVP because people were just didn't want to debate Embiid versus Jokic anymore. They're like, wait, isn't Giannis actually like, you know, like, can't I just vote for Giannis?
Yeah.
But yeah, Mobley, a part of it too is he played 79 games. He's a ton of minutes, 2,700 minutes, which is pretty rare in the NBA these days. And a guy who can guard out on the perimeter, like just bothers the hell out of everybody with the ball, without the ball. Like, the opposing defense or opposing offenses are just scared that Evan Mobley's going to switch onto their guy. And he's a complete disruptor, which is partially why I like Jaren Jackson over Lopez anyways, because I prefer the more versatile guys.
Yeah, I really don't feel strongly about this one. Like as a Bucks fan, it'd be very cool if Brook Lopez won it. I think as kind of a almost a you know, what do you call it, lifetime achievement award.
Sure.
You know, just a recognition for having this year, you know, coming off of back surgery at this age. But I also hate when people make that argument for other awards. You know, where it's like, well, you got to factor in where he came from and, you know, all the adversity. It's like, no, man, you do need to view this as a vacuum award. You know, it's just these 82 games, no matter whatever happened in the playoffs last year, doesn't matter. Whatever happened in the regular season last year, doesn't matter. Whatever you think is going to happen in the playoffs this year, doesn't matter. So if that means that it's Mobley, I'm totally, totally fine with that. I will admit I am not a defensive savant by any means. And I still don't think there's like a great stat that no. really encompasses everything. I mean, what do you look for if you're looking at defensive numbers? Like, I know you're like cleaning the glass has some things, but I think there's kind of an agreement that defensive stats still have a ways to go.
It's still so much eye test. Like, you would have to sit down and find like five games from each of these guys, their five best defensive games, and just watch them. And so much of this is too, like, you know, I went back today to prepare a little bit for this Hawks Heat series and like watched a bunch of those games, and Bam Adebayo is just, he's switching on to everybody. He switched on to Trae Young, bothered Trae Young. He's at the back of the rim contesting shots. He's doing a little bit of everything. And I mean, there's going to be some numbers, you know, like expected field goal percentage, location, but you got to have subscriptions to all these websites to like, you know that. I don't think there's a great defensive stat. I still think it's more eye test and seeing a guy switch onto somebody else with the ball and that person with the ball just going, absolutely not. I will pass and let someone else do it. Or, you know, a guy running at towards the rim and Mobley steps in and they're like, oh God. And they just throw up some complete garbage. So I think it's stuff like that where the numbers aren't going to really show you that as much as an in-person viewing would.
I wonder who's going to get the guard all defense spots. So like positions are kind of a mess here. Like we could assume that it's like Mobley or Lopez. You know, maybe you could kind of make Jaren Jackson a forward, Giannis a forward. Like those are kind of the four guys who've been competing for the award. I would assume Drew Holiday probably gets one. Who gets the other guard spot? Is there anybody obvious that I'm missing?
I mean, I think Caruso, but I don't know.
I need to look back while you're thinking on this and see if there's any precedent for guys who played like that few minutes being on the first team all defense. Maybe.
Yeah. 1500 minutes for him. Jimmy Butler's a forward. I'm just going down the box plus minus right now.
Yeah.
Obviously a Okoro, but he's more of a small forward at this point. SGA maybe has an argument.
Yeah. If you're just looking at steals, that was kind of the name I was going to bring up. For what it's worth, by the way, they don't seem to do positions all that much. Like last year's first team was Gobert, Giannis, and Jaren Jackson, plus McCall Bridges and Marcus Smart. So I guess in that scenario, McCall Bridges is the shooting guard.
Yeah, I can see Smart. I don't know if Smart's going to sneak on this year.
I don't think he will. I think there's kind of a reversal because everybody feels like he probably shouldn't have won Defensive Player of the Year last year anyway. And by the way, Matisse Thybulle's been second team all defense each of the last 2 years. So minutes wise, I would imagine he probably played even fewer than Caruso, or at least around the same amount.
He had to. I mean, Thybulle barely played this year. I'm trying to pull it up right now.
Yeah, well, I'm saying last year. You know,
last year.
Yeah, so like if somebody like that can make second team, then yeah, Caruso should be in the running.
It's about the same. Okay. Last year he played 1600 minutes. This year Thybulle played 1200 minutes.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe Marcus Smart could sneak on again.
Maybe people just go Drew Holiday, SGA, you know, it could be.
I would be mostly okay with that. Yeah. I mean, I also think a lot of voters are probably not like super, super locked in when they're filling out, you know, the guard spots for all defense. Like I think you'd really have to go back and do a lot of looking. I mean, Anthony Edwards is going to be in that conversation. He has a bunch of steals. He's a good defender. Van Vliet's always up there in terms of steals. Can you make Ananobi a shooting guard?
Well, he's kind of playing shooting guard after the trade.
Yeah, right.
I think he's
the guy.
What about De'Anthony Melton?
Ooh. Yeah, I think he would be the Thybulle-ish vote for this year. Yeah, I'd be okay with any of these guys. You know, I mean, Herb Jones still rates pretty well in a lot of metrics. I think he's kind of like OG. You could probably make him a shooting guard.
Yeah.
I think we've pretty much covered it here.
Fultz has some really good defensive moments too. He had some great shot blocks. Crazy athlete. I mean, if you just sort by steal percentage, it's Caruso and Melton, and then you know you feel out your balance. Yeah. If you're one of those people, but
okay. Well, everybody had been hitting us up and saying like we got to talk about all defensive guard spots for 10 minutes at the end of the pod. So you're welcome. We finally did it. But we will be going a lot deeper on the play-in games this week. You could find us at SiriusXM NBA Radio Channel 86, 7 p.m. Eastern until 7:30. We'll be breaking down Hawks Heat and Lakers Timberwolves tonight. Very much looking forward to that. You'll be back. We kind of weird schedule this week because you know there's off days mixed in. We got an early start in the play-in games tomorrow, so no show Wednesday, no show Thursday. I will be gone this weekend out in Vegas, so you'll be hosting with Joe Bartel on Friday. But make sure you turn into the Roto NBA show. What am I saying? Make sure you tune into the RotoWire NBA show on SiriusXM NBA Radio Channel 86. Again, that is 7 to 7:30 p.m. Eastern.